Case number 21-1663, United States versus Adam Brown. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Shad, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Mr. Shad. Good to see you at an oral argument again.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you for having me.
Well,
I am
How are you going to top the pancake challenge?
I don't think I can. I thought I had a good argument, and then Judge Gilman just took the feet out from under me here. So, Your Honors, I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Okay. We noticed that on your brief, you've already won one issue. On the strength of
I'm halfway there.
Your excellent brief.
So, yes.
We will take the concession of error by the government on that issue, so you can argue the other issues.
Thank you. Yes. So Mr. Brown was actually convicted of two counts that created a mandatory life sentence. Counts 1 and 6. Judge Griffin, as you just said, they've conceded on count 1. So I want to spend all of my time talking about count 6 and why you need to overturn on count 6 as well. And therefore, this matter has to be remanded for resentencing to hopefully a term of years as opposed to a mandatory life sentence. There are at least three reasons why count 6 needs to be overturned. And the first one that I'll turn to is a direct sufficiency of the evidence claim. And I will recognize up front that a sufficiency of the evidence claim is tough to win, but I've never seen a record that is better to win a sufficiency of the evidence claim. And I say that because this count is comprised of two different factors. One, you have to have the distribution up front, and then you have to have the distribution of some specific drugs that are the but-for cause of the serious bodily injury to Mr. Keon. And the government's evidence actually doesn't hit the mark on either end of that, and it misses the mark fairly badly. And as a matter of fact, there is no evidence in the record to support a finding of guilt on either of those elements. And so I'd like to first start with the fact that the government needs to prove at some point in the process that drugs were distributed. And they have no evidence to support that. That in their brief, they cite to basically three facts to support the fact that drugs were distributed by Mr. Brown on January 24th. And those facts are that there is a telephone call between Mr. Brown's number and Mr. Keon's number that lasted 87 seconds. We don't know the content of that call. Nobody has discussed what was discussed in that call. We just know that those phones connected for 87 seconds on that day. The second piece of evidence that the government relies on is that at some point after that phone call, Mr. Brown's phone was in the general vicinity of Mr. Keon's phone. And for a period of time up to an hour. But as their expert admits, they were using, to prove that relative area, they were using a method which is not GPS, but which is cell phone location. And as their expert, Mr. Reinhart, admits, when you're using cell phone connections like that, and you're using cell tower connections like that, there's a ton of play that comes into account that can show that the persons are actually potentially miles away from each other while they're connected to a particular cell phone. But even if you take the government's evidence at its best, which is that they were in the same general location for a period of time on the 24th, it doesn't get you to the fact that a drug transaction occurred. And there's...
You actually have to go back to mid-January with the text messages between the two of them talking about drug deals, including fentanyl.
Yeah, and
it's not like this has just popped up out of nowhere.
So we admit that Mr. Brown sold to Mr. Keon and he sold heroin to Mr. Keon. Now, we will dispute that it was fentanyl. So there's two pieces of evidence that talk about whether or not Mr. Brown, well, there's three, that talk about whether Mr. Brown was selling fentanyl. And those are, number one, that he was arrested three times by police. All of these were introduced into trial. Every time he's arrested, he has heroin on him, no fentanyl, all during the relevant time period. Number two, you have the fact that he talked about, he talked in mid-January about, I've got that white fire, right? And so their expert, their agent actually comes in and testifies, well, fire means fentanyl.
Does it really matter if your client knew he was selling fentanyl as opposed to heroin or some other illegal drug? I mean,
no. Case law says that as long as he knew he was selling drugs and that those drugs were ingested by the person, and then that person had serious bodily injury but for the use of those drugs, that it doesn't matter that Mr. Brown knew what they were. But I think to Judge McKeague's point, there is no proof that he actually was dealing in fentanyl. And I think the best...
We've had other cases like this that the drugs they thought they were, the buyer was buying, thought that was heroin, ended up being fentanyl, and the fentanyl killed him. I mean, this is now a real common occurrence, unfortunately, all over the place. And if they've got an ongoing dealer relationship, I mean, there's circumstantial evidence. I mean, you're saying there's no direct evidence of a drug deal the circumstances, you could have a reasonable inference that they've done it in the past, this was their mode of operation, and that continued on to this thing. I mean, we can use circumstantial evidence if it's a reasonable inference.
Right? Yes, you can use circumstantial evidence. There can't be a reasonable inference here for two reasons. One is there's no testimony or evidence that there's this mode of operation, that this is the way they did their deals. Another thing is that normally in drug deals, it's a hand-to-hand transaction. Each person goes his way. If you take the government's evidence on its face, they were in the same general facility for an hour. That's not indicative of a drug deal.
Well, are they friends? What else would they be doing?
That's the question, right? What else would they be doing? Now,
they didn't get together socially, did they?
Well, Mr. Brown gave evidence that he was at a Walmart at the time, which is that Walmart was within the scope of where that cell phone tower hit. He also had evidence that, unfortunately, the district court didn't allow him to present that shows that he was actually interacting with another person at that time, working on a drug deal, and was going to meet them in that area. And so there's all kinds of evidence that he may have been in that area, he may have been doing a drug deal, but there's just you can't make a reasonable inference.
Aren't these arguments for the jury, though? I mean, issues of fact, and like you said, I mean, it's been a long time since I've reversed a case based on insufficiency of evidence, because the standard is so high that no reasonable juror could have come to this based upon the evidence, and it's a high bar.
It's a very high bar, but in this case, there has to be some evidence of actual distribution.
Okay.
That is the element that in just this inference that, well, they may have gotten together and they may have been in the general vicinity on this date doesn't get you there. I mean, if we take a look at cell tower evidence today, it would show that all our cell phones are in the same general area. It doesn't mean that we were having a drug deal with each other.
How about the evidence that shows that on the 22nd there were text exchanges that Keon's looking for drugs and he's going to be able to repay Brown for previous drug debt and presumably get more drugs on Wednesday the 24th, which is when all this happened.
And the problem with that evidence is that, again, the kind of the second half of the coin, which is that the district court didn't allow in the other cell phone evidence and the other text messages that occurred on the 25th, which showed that they never, in fact, got together on the 24th, that he never did pay him back. So even if you take into account that on the 22nd, Mr. Keon said that he was going to pay him back on the 24th and he wanted to get more, we know for a fact through these other cell phone messages that didn't happen and they never got together and he never paid them back. So it couldn't have been a drug transaction on the 24th.
Wait, the 25th was not with really Keon. It was with the police that were posing as Keon.
Absolutely. But Mr. Brown didn't know that. And on top of that, I point this out in my brief. Obviously, the police were acting as Keon, trying to get incriminating evidence from Mr. Brown. It backfired in their face because no drug transaction ever occurred. And so now, because it didn't work out for them, they then successfully got to where that evidence couldn't be used and put in front of the jury. If a jury would have heard that evidence, they would have acquitted.
Putting the cart before the horse here, in terms of starting with sufficiency, because what you're claiming evidence is a lack of sufficient evidence is premised on information that you were just saying the jury didn't hear. So if we look at what the jury heard, then Judge Griffin was discussing with you whether there was sufficient evidence. You really have to get in what your premise is here. You have to overcome that hearsay objection to the evidence that wasn't admitted. And
yes.
Then you can argue, when you add that in, insufficiency. Am I right about that?
You are right, but it's more nuanced than that, because not only, so as I pointed out in my brief, when this first came up, the defense tried to get it through another witness, and the government said, the only way this comes in is if Mr. Brown gets up and testifies. Mr. Brown did get up and testify, and then they still objected, and the district court still didn't let this evidence in. But it wasn't just merely the texts themselves. Mr. Brown wasn't permitted to talk about the texts and talk about the fact that he texted with Keon the next day in his testimony. So it's not only the hearsay of the specific...
Was there an objection to that at the time?
Yes. Yes, there was a significant objection to that at the time. Yes. Yes, Your Honor. So we have here that, and I think you're right, Judge McKeague, I really need to get in that evidence, but it doesn't need to be the face of the text themselves, although those are admissible, we believe, to be able to present our defense because they're clearly exonerating. And there's no proof that they're anything but exonerating as to count six, because they specifically say, I didn't meet with you yesterday, you didn't pay me, and I didn't give you anything since last week. And so because of that, those text messages and testimony about those text messages should have been allowed to be presented by Mr. Brown during his testimony. I see that I'm out of time, so the only other issue I was going to raise was 851, but it's in my briefs.
Okay, you'll have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mark Chasteen appearing for the United States. I will pick up where Mr. Shad argued, and that is on the sufficiency of the evidence as to count six. And as the court has rightly observed, there is sufficient, or there is quite a bit of circumstantial evidence on the points that Mr. Shad seeks to challenge here in his argument today.
Assuming that you're right, that the text messages themselves were hearsay, and that it could come in through Brown if he testifies, what Mr. Shad claims is that he tried to testify that he sent these text messages. Maybe he couldn't put the text messages in to corroborate that, but was he prohibited from testifying that he had these exchanges the next day that were arguably exculpatory?
He was not permitted to testify about the substances of the text messages, but he did testify that, in fact, he had a telephone conversation with Mr. Keon on the afternoon of January 24th, and that they were going to meet, I believe, but then he never did meet with Mr. Keon that day, never met with him again, never ever distributed fentanyl to him in any way.
Why wouldn't he have been permitted to testify about what happened on the 25th?
He, on the 25th?
The next day. That was where Mr. Chad left off.
Because that would just be another way of getting hearsay evidence. And the same very substance of the text, if you're just testifying them about what the text themselves were, would be the same hearsay as putting in the texts themselves. So they're out of court. The texts themselves were out of court statements by him. And just him coming in and then testifying about something he said out of court doesn't cure the hearsay problem. It's still hearsay.
Now, is it asserted for the truth of the matter asserted, though? I mean, is that the...
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor, that below, Mr. Keon's attorney assured the court, the district court, that he was not attempting to introduce these texts for the truth of the matter asserted. Rather, he made other... exceptions, the prior or the state of mind and consistent or completeness rule, but that he was not introducing them for the truth of the matter asserted. Yet the only justification that we hear now on appeal to introduce these is very much for the truth of the matter asserted. In other words, it has no evidentiary relevance other than to prove exactly what Mr. Brown's attorney said below he was not trying to prove, which is that the substance of the underlying statements. If he's not trying to introduce it for the truth of the matter asserted, there's no reason to introduce these texts. And what we have not heard from Mr. Shadd and Mr. Brown on appeal is any case that says that it is a constitutional violation for a court to exclude hearsay evidence by a defendant of his own statement. The cases that I've cited are sort of different and are unusual evidentiary rules, but even the Supreme Court in the Sheffer case points to Rule 802, the hearsay rule, as a legitimate hearsay or evidentiary rule that the courts can apply, and this court has said that as well in its cases, that the rule or straightforward application of the rules of evidence, such in this case, cannot be a constitutional violation when it serves a legitimate interest. Which
what do you say to Mr. Shadd's point, though, that there's not enough even circumstantial evidence to meet the minimum standard for a jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Brown sold the drugs to Mr. Keon?
So I think that the timeline is important in this case, and it really extends back before January of 2018, but all the way back to January or October of 2016. There's testimony in the record from Kimberly O'Connor that when she and Mr. Brown's co-defendant, James Sharp, known as Stoney, were arrested at a Red Roof or near a Red Roof Inn at a CVS with fentanyl-laced heroin, that they had received that fentanyl-laced heroin from Mr. Brown. Then go to October 2017, the death of Alex Brenner. Terrence Robinson testified that Alex Brenner got that fentanyl-laced heroin from Adam Brown. And then we have, go to January of 2018, where, as the court has pointed out, Mr. Keon reached out to Mr. Brown in text messages, and Mr. Brown actually told him that he was back with the usual fire, and Mr. Keon said that fire white. And then 2 days before Mr. Keon overdoses on January 24th, there's this text exchange where Mr. Keon indicates that he's interested in buying more from Mr. Brown in addition to paying back the $40 he owed them. 2 days later, on January 24th, there's the text or the phone call between the two, Mr. Brown and Mr. Keon, at about 12:47 for 87 seconds. And then there was the cell location evidence that Mr. Shadd discussed. So following that call, they're in separate locations. And then the cell location evidence is that they both began to move to a different location, which is consistent with what we also saw with Alex Brenner's death the year before, a few months earlier, actually. He makes a call, or he and Mr. Robinson make calls, and then Mr. Brenner's phone and Mr. Brown's phones move. They're together for a period of time, and then they go back to their separate locations. The same thing happened with Mr. Keon in January. So they both come, Mr. Brown from the area of his house, Mr. Keon from a different area. They both travel down to the area near Mr. Keon's house, and then Mr. Brown's phone moves on and then eventually goes back to his house. So it's more than just location. It's the timing of the call, prompting movement of the phone. They come together in the same area, and then they separate.
What it comes down to, you say there's enough circumstantial evidence, Mr. Shadd says there's not, and then you claim you win based on the standard we apply to sufficiency. Right?
And that is the outcome that should occur, Judge McKee, because that is what the law says. If it's you know, circumstantial evidence and the jury can make these reasonable inferences, then it's certainly sufficient evidence. And then as we go through the timing, of course, Mr. Keon comes home, and shortly thereafter, his mother testifies, goes into his bedroom, comes out, says, whatever happens, don't call 911, and then passes out. There was evidence in the record from Dr. Mills. We see from the first responders that they had to administer three doses of Narcan, which every one of them said does not respond to non-opiates. So the other drugs that were found in Mr. Keon's system, benzodiazepine, would not be affected by Narcan, but he eventually did come back.
Could you talk a little bit about the packaging, because I thought that was a little bit confusing reading the briefs. You seem to say that what was found, that apparently his mother hid it and then she gave it back to him the next day. Do you claim that packaging was the same packaging that Brown was known to use when he distributed these drugs?
The other instance of him using that was with Alex Brenner's, the substances that he bought was also in tinfoil packaging. I cannot say that the evidence showed that he uniformly always used that package, but there was evidence in the record that he had used that before, a few months earlier, with respect to the transaction that resulted in Alex Brenner's death.
So I'm guessing use of tinfoil, just like a little cutoff baggie, is not unusual, right? So in and of itself, that wouldn't tell you much.
It's a one piece of the puzzle, Your Honor. As far as that it was fentanyl that caused the death, as I was saying, Dr. Mills testified that in light of all of the evidence that he reviewed, including the use of Narcan, Mr. Keon's responsiveness to it, that he remained alert after he received that and didn't revert back to a groggy state from some other drug, and that, you know, the next day when he overdosed again and died, there was fentanyl and metabolites of fentanyls in his system. There was sufficient evidence to find that fentanyl caused Mr. Keon's loss of consciousness and substantial injury the day before on January 24th. I would like to address, just briefly if I could, the argument that was in the brief that the jury's question as to count six about whether they had to find fentanyl shows that there was somehow insufficient evidence or jury confusion. The jury was specifically instructed both as to count five and count six multiple times that they had to find that Mr. Brown knowingly distributed fentanyl to Alex Brenner as to count five and Jeffrey Keon in count six. So, and that it was that same fentanyl, the jury instruction said, that caused either the death or the substantial bodily injury. So when the district court referred the jury back to its instructions and specifically cited the page numbers that they should look at, the district court did in fact answer the jury's question by saying, you know, we're an hour into deliberations, please refer to the instructions that I've given you that specifically answer this question. Mr. Chad indicated that he'd like to talk about the 851 issue, and I assume he's referring to his challenge that the, he sort of raises two challenges. One is that count five should be, the sentence of that should have been limited to 5 years. Again, noting that the jury necessarily made a finding that fentanyl was involved for count five because of the court's jury instructions, there was in fact a jury finding in the record that fentanyl was involved. Count five, which is under 841B1C, the sentence only requires there be a prior felony drug offense, not a serious drug offense, unlike 841B1A and B. So that means all there was necessary for the court to enhance under count five was a finding of the type, which we have in this case with the jury's verdict, where they instructed they had to find fentanyl. The fact that there was a prior conviction, which under Almendarez-Torres and that line of cases is something for the court to find, and then the court to determine that this person has been convicted of a drug offense involving either a Schedule One or Schedule Two controlled substance. Fentanyl is specifically listed in Schedule 2. So there is no Sixth Amendment issue with respect to count 5. On count 6, the recent Fields opinion that was cited by Mr. Shad in his appeal
or his reply brief, I think is helpful, although it is not dispositive in the way that Mr. Shad has argued. And that is because in Fields, the court specifically made the distinction that I just made, and that is 841B1C has a different definition for what type of prior conviction has to be found in order for the jury or for the court to enhance a penalty. There are no requirements of incarceration-related facts, as the court called them, in Fields. In other words, there is no necessary finding that the conviction resulted in the person serving over 12 months in prison, or that that person was released, the defendant was released within 15 months of the current offense. So the court specifically distinguished in Fields the very kind of conviction and sentence that is at issue in this case, whereas Fields concerned the other type, where the jury, or where there did have to be a finding for those incarceration-related facts. Here, there was no necessity for anybody to make those kind of facts findings in order for the enhancement to apply. So to the extent that the defense is arguing that a mandatory life sentence was inappropriate because the jury didn't make necessary findings, that was not required under the Sixth Amendment case law or the statute. As for the notice argument, I think the record is clear that Mr. Brown knew that he was facing life sentences, both in the acknowledgement that he signed and by specifically being put on notice during a pretrial hearing by the prosecutor. I see that my time is almost up, so I'd like to ask if the court has any questions for me.
Further questions, Judge Gilman, Judge McKeague. All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chad, you've got 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge McKeague, I just want to make sure that we're on the same page with regards to, you're right in that, you know, I argue there's not enough circumstantial evidence. He argues that there is, and this court's going to have to use the standard of review to decide whether or not the record reflects it. I just want to make sure that the correct standard of review is used, because the government argued in their brief that this issue is completely waived. For two reasons. One is that I only argued this issue for one sentence, and two, that it was never preserved in the court below. I cited in my reply brief that I actually argue on this issue for 4 pages in my brief, and that there's at least 2 instances in the record where it was preserved through General Rule 29 arguments, both at the end of the government's case and at the end of all the case. I found when I was preparing for oral argument that, in fact, there was also a written Rule 29 at the end of the case that was filed that also preserves the more robust standard of review for sufficiency of the evidence as to count 6. So when the court is making its review, it's a de novo standard of review on sufficiency of the evidence, taking all of the evidence in light most favorable to the government. Is there evidence in the record to actually support the elements that I was arguing about today? And I would just submit that if I'm a drug dealer and I sell on 3 occasions to someone, the government shouldn't be able to get a conviction by saying, well, on another day, I had a phone call with the guy, and I was in the area later on in the day. That shouldn't be enough for not only a federal conviction, but also a mandatory life, which is what we're talking about here, that you've got to uphold this particular conviction is the only thing getting him mandatory life at this point. If this is overturned, he still goes back for resentencing. He still faces up to 30 years in prison for the other counts, some of which he actually pled guilty to. And he fully admits that he's a drug dealer. He fully admits that he sold the Keon on occasion. There's just not evidence that he sold the Keon on January the 24th. And with all due respect to opposing counsel, the evidence of the overdose on the 25th doesn't get them to the drugs that Mr. Brown sold and distributed to Keon were the but-for causation of his overdose. The only evidence in the record is that he went to the hospital. The hospital prepared a record. That record said on the 24th that he overdosed on the benzodiazepine and another opioid, but it didn't say anything about heroin or fentanyl. And you can't get there based upon the record that the government presented. So unless there are any other questions, we would ask that you reverse on count six and for the arguments that are stated in my brief.
Other questions? Judge Gilman? Judge King? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.